Hi there, I'm Dan Beswick, and this is Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out. I'm in Los Angeles, California, and today I'm joined by Dr. Martin Sittardi and Dr. Daniel Zhao in Houston, Texas. We'll be discussing their team's recent publication, Cost Utility Analysis of Fluticasone Exhalation Delivery System versus Budesonide Nasal Irrigation for Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyps. Daniel and Dr. Sittardi, thanks so much for taking the time to be here with us. It's great to have you. So this is a great article. I mean, I think one of the things that a lot of us consider primarily postoperatively, but at different phases of sort of the patient's care cycle, is how are we going to administer topical nasal steroids and what's going to be the most effective and what are the other thoughts, you know, and considerations around that. So as we sort of get started talking about your article, can you tell me a bit about sort of where you drew your inspiration from? How did you decide to study this and put a cost perspective on it?
That's a great question. We're all familiar with both treatment arms in the clinical sense, but they have, you know, very good data around exhalational delivery system for fluticasone. And we all have experience with budesonide irrigations, and there's some data about that. But they've never been really directly compared clinically, but more importantly, economically, because we have to come up with solutions that are acceptable to patients from a cost standpoint, because patients are paying for some of it out of pocket, and they want to be sure they're getting value for that. So we just wanted to compare both arms based on the available data and do an economic analysis versus just a clinical outcome analysis.
That's a great point. And I think it's going to be well received by the field. I think a lot of people are interested in these results. I should mention at the offset that, you know, the budesonide part of this, we should just say, isn't typically used, at least when I use it, it's an off-label use. So I just wanted to clarify that for our listeners as well. Daniel, can you talk to us a bit about some of the methodology that you used and walk us through some of the modeling and how you launched into some of the cost analyses?
For sure, yeah. So for this, I generated like a model in Triage Pro. And so there are basically two treatment arms, one where we used the standard like budesonide saline nasal irrigation, and the other one was the exhalation delivery system with fluticasone. And so essentially these patients could start on these medications, and if they responded well, they could continue on this, or if they didn't respond well enough, they could progress to revision surgery and then back onto this medication afterwards. And then, you know, in terms of the model inputs, there are three key ones that we need for these models. So the first is like transitional probabilities, you know, so the probability that, you know, treatment fails and you have to go to surgery. That was obtained through the primary literature. Another input that we need is cost, which we can go more in depth into later. But our model used sort of real world costs. It's, you know, this analysis is typically done from like a payer perspective with Medicare, but since EDS flu is not covered by Medicare, it made things a little bit more complicated.
How'd you handle that?
Yeah, so we ended up using sort of real-world like cost data that we got from UT Health Systems. They sort of have a database where they collect prices that insurance company pays as well as how much the patient ends up paying. So we ended up combining those two costs and taking the average out of like all the patients that they had. So that was one way we worked around that shortfall, I guess. And then lastly, the last input we needed was the health utility values, which we sort of obtained from the primary literature. There were a lot of randomized controlled trials that got SNOT-22 data, and so there was a formula that you could use to translate SNOT-22 into health utility values.
That's good. And just help us understand, I know some of us are familiar with health utility value and some are not, but would you help just make sure everybody knows a bit more about that concept?
For sure, yeah. So health utility values, they can range from 0 to 1, with 0 being death and then 1 being perfectly healthy. In terms of the treatment, it can fall somewhere anywhere between there.
Perfect. And you took the SNOT-22 values and transformed those into health utility values, which you used in your subsequent analyses. I see.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the issue of cost.
Yes.
Because when we were putting this together, we had this amongst ourselves, we were debating, do we consider cost from the patient's out-of-pocket perspective? Because that's really what we're trying to, you know, provide guidance around, or look at it from an economic total cost to the system perspective. And we chose the latter, because in part because we had access to this UT system claims database. But the other thing that came out of the call, but looking at that further, are two things. For budesonide, there are dozens and dozens of different variations of budesonide that is available. And they vary in cost by tenfold or more sometimes. And so it makes me wonder, when we do compounding and we're going for a less expensive compound, what we're actually getting. It may not be the same as something that's more expensive. So there's a warning in there, I think, for how we use compounding pharmacies. I mean, this is not obviously in the paper, sort of an observation along the way. And then the other thing about the cost database that we could not, the data we got from the claims database, is it did not include rebates that pharma companies pay to insurance companies at the PBMs. So the effective cost may be less because of these nested rebates that happen. And it's simply not reported, and it's not knowable about how that would impact what the system is truly paying for any treatment.
That sounds complex.
It's a separate topic, but the whole role of PBMs in the system, the pharmacy benefit managers in the system, really makes any of these analyses very difficult, because we never have a full data set. And pharma drives a lot of the expense in the entire system. And it's just sort of a caveat that we have to sort of keep in mind, that we have an imperfect view of the world.
That's a fair point. Thank you for clarifying for us. Thanks for talking about the cost and the methods. Daniel, would you be willing to talk about some of the main findings and results with us?
For sure. Yeah. In our findings, we found that EDS flu was sort of more effective compared to budesonide. EDS flu produced like 1.66 qualies, while budesonide only produced 1.25. However, EDS flu cost a lot more. It was roughly like $141,000 at the end of the 33-year time horizon that we had in our study, whereas budesonide was a lot cheaper. It was only around $40,000 at the end of the 33 years. So when you actually end up calculating the ICER, it ends up being around $250,000 per quali. And so in our study, we chose to use a willingness to pay threshold of $50,000. So this ended up being way over our willingness to pay. So our main finding was that SNI was the more cost-effective strategy.
Got it. Thank you for sharing that. Let's dive into a couple of those terms, just to make sure we're all on the same page. Can you describe the quality-adjusted life year for us and how that's measured over time?
Yeah, so that's sort of derived from the health utility values. That's sort of just, tallied up after the study period of the 33 years that we did.
Got it. And then what about the ICER? Tell us how that factors in, please.
For sure. Yeah. So, in terms of doing this cost benefit analysis, there's a lot of different outcomes you can have, where one strategy A is more effective and less expensive. And so we would say, strategy A dominates strategy B, whereas there's other outcomes where you can have, strategy A is more expensive, but more effective. And so in this case, you need to decide whether, strategy A or strategy B is better. And so in that case, that's where the ICER, or the incremental cost effectiveness ratio, comes into play. And so you can compare your ICER to your willingness to pay threshold. And so if your ICER is less than your willingness to pay threshold, then we say, strategy A would be more cost effective. Whereas if it was higher than your willingness to pay threshold, then strategy B might be more cost effective.
Thank you. That makes sense. I appreciate you clarifying. And then, the threshold is an interesting topic, right? Different countries have different healthcare systems. Sometimes we hear about that a lot in the UK, who has a nationalized healthcare system. How did you arrive at the $50,000 for the willingness to pay? And can you provide some context around that?
So the willingness to pay threshold sort of came upon after looking at some other cost-effective analyses. That just seemed something that was standard. Of course, when we were getting feedback for this paper from the reviewers, as well as later on the letter from Dr. Hong, it was brought up that, this $50,000 willingness to pay threshold might not be sort of the standard, and that, it might be sort of outdated. And so that's sort of where we, in our response, came up with the incremental net monetary benefit versus like the willingness to pay sort of graph that we came up with. So, incremental net monetary benefit utilizes the willingness to pay threshold for the calculation. And so you can input that for each one for the calculation, and then see which one's more cost effective. So in our graph, we showed that no matter what willingness to pay threshold that we chose, budesonide ended up being more cost effective up until the willingness to pay threshold of $350,000.
So it sounds like you ran the analyses multiple ways, and the results consistently, is it correct to say the results consistently showed that budesonide appeared more cost effective?
Yeah, interesting.
I think it's important for the listeners to appreciate that the willingness to pay threshold is almost a policy decision. And that $50,000 number came up in the U.S., I think back in the 80s, and it's the traditional number that's been used for 30 or 40 years now. But it's a policy decision, and some people argue that it should be a measure of per capita GDP to, you know, basically get a different socioeconomic status of different countries. But you can do that analysis repeatedly, indefinitely. And that's what we did in response to the reviewers, and it really didn't change the fundamental conclusion.
Interesting.
And so I think when you look at this type of paper, the message is not in the absolute numbers. The message is sort of in the directionality. That's how you use it as a clinician. It's not that you're going to, you know, spend X number of dollars or save the system dollars going one way or the other. It's more of a computer experiment to show the right way to make a decision. It's not economic dollars and cents.
I see. That makes sense too. Great points. Were there any findings in the study or in your analysis that were surprising, that were unanticipated?
Well, I'll start with this. I mean, the thing that was most confusing to me was trying to figure out how much budesonide cost, because there were so many different variations in different payments for budesonide in terms of how we were going to do it. And that took a lot of effort going back and forth to the source. So for me, that was really interesting. Because some of the budesonide is tablet. And I think some of the compounding pharmacies are probably grinding tablets and using that in prescription versus budesonide that comes as a solution. For our study, we just used a budesonide in solution, the one that is available for nebulization. But I don't think every patient is actually receiving that practically.
I see. Well, this has been, it's some really interesting findings so far. Are there any broader implications that you see out of this, or any steps that you plan to take in the future with your research group to extend this work?
We would like to do additional work with the UT system claims database. I mean, one obvious question I think most people are probably thinking about is biologics versus surgery.
Yeah, huge gap in the field. Huge opportunity there.
Yeah, it gets a little bit more complicated in querying the database for surgical procedures versus just pharma.
I see.
So it's a little more complicated to work with. And I think we probably also need more claims in the claims database to begin to pull it out.
Hmm.
But that's something that we've talked about doing.
I see. And is this database something specific to your institution, or could you share a bit more about that?
So it's a UT system initiative. It looks at claims data from the UT system employees.
Hmm.
And so the legislature a few years ago wanted to stand up a database looking at this. I think to save in part on premiums that the university pays for its own employees, to be honest with you.
I see.
But it also is available for, you know, academic purposes. I think there's a group out of Austin that runs it. You just have to, they're swamped with queries. They're very busy, but we were able to get data from them for this project.
It sounds like a great resource and great opportunity to use to do projects such as this one.
Right. Yeah, especially because a lot of these claims databases are proprietary and sold, right? We would never have access to it as an academic group unless we're going to pay, you know, significant fees for doing it.
Got it. I'm glad you have it and were able to use it for this. Anything else that you'd like to share with us today, either about the article or any context or background or anything related?
I think, again, I commented on it, but I think it's really important. It's, you get a sense of directionality in the value proposition for these two medications. It doesn't say which one you use when, but again, if we're trying to, you know, be responsible physicians, there's some clear implications here of which treatment should be first line and which treatment could be a second line if the first line doesn't work.
I hear you. That conclusion reads through in the paper and it definitely makes sense. Well, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate your time. Thanks for discussing the article with us. Once again, we have Mr. Zhao and Dr. Sitardi from the University of Texas at Houston. And thank you again for taking the time to be here. It was great to talk with you.